those tasting hell, Martian radios were beaming this message to Earth in a maddening sing-song. Brown man, white man, yellow man. Surrender or die. Brown man, white man, yellow man. Surrender or die. Chapter 6. A Deserter in Time of War.
I am at a loss to understand why German batball is not an event, possibly a key event, in the Olympic Games.
Winston Niles Rumford. It was a 6-mile march from the army camp to the plain where the invasion fleet lay, and the route of the march cut across the northwest corner of Phoebe, the only city on Mars. The population of Phoebe at its height, according to Winston Niles Rumford's Pocket History of Mars, was 87,000. Every soul and every structure in Phoebe was directly related to the war effort. The mass of Phoebe's workers were controlled just as the soldiers were controlled, by antennas under their skulls. Unk's company was now marching through the northwest corner of Phoebe, on its way in the midst of its regiment to the fleet. It was thought unnecessary now to keep the soldiers moving and in ranks by means of twinges from their antennas. War fever had them now. They chanted as they marched, and set their iron-heeled boots down hard on the iron street. Their chant was bloody. Terror, grief, and desolation. Hut, tup, thrup, foe. Come to every earthling nation. Hut, tup, thrup, foe. Earth, eat fire. Earth, wear chains. Hut, tup, thrup, foe. Break earth's spirits. Spill earth's brains. Hut, tup, thrup, foe. Scream, tup, thrup, foe. Bleed, tup, thrup, foe. Die, tup, thrup, foe. Doom.
The factories of Phoebe were still going full blast. No one was idling in the streets to watch the chanting heroes pass. Windows winked as dazzling torches inside went off and on. A doorway vomited spattering, smoking yellow light as metal was poured. The screams of grinding wheels cut through the soldiers' chant. 3 flying saucers, blue scout ships, skimmed low over the city, making sweet cooing sounds like singing tops. Toodaloo, they seemed to sing, as they skimmed away in a flat course while the surface of Mars curved away beneath them. In 2 shakes of a lamb's tail, they were twinkling in space eternal.
Terror, grief, and desolation, chanted the troops.
But one soldier was moving his lips without making a sound. The soldier was Unk. Unk was in the first file of the next-to-last rank of his company. Boaz was right behind him, his eyes making the back of Unk's neck itch. Boaz and Unk, moreover, were made Siamese twins by the long tube of a 6-inch siege mortar which they were carrying between them.
Bleed, tup, thrup, foe, chanted the troops. Die, tup, thrup, foe. Doom.
Unk, old buddy, said Boaz.
Yes, old buddy, Unk said absently.
He was holding, amid the confusion of his soldier's harness, a live hand grenade. The pin had been pulled. To make it go off in 3 seconds, Unk had only to let go of it.
I done fixed us up with a good assignment, old buddy, said Boaz. Old Boaz, he takes care of his buddy. Don't he, buddy?
That's right, buddy, said Unk.
Boaz had arranged things so that he and Unk would be on board the company mothership for the invasion. The company mothership, though it would, through a logistical fluke, be carrying the tube of the siege mortar, was essentially a non-combat ship. It was meant to carry only 2 men, the rest of the space being taken up by candy, sporting goods, recorded music, canned hamburgers, board games, goofballs, soft drinks, Bibles, notepaper, barber kits, ironing boards, and other morale builders.
That's a lucky start, ain't it, old buddy? Getting on the mothership?
Lucky us, old buddy, said Unc. He had just chucked the grenade into a sewer as he passed. There was a spout and roar from the throat of the sewer. The soldiers hurled themselves to the street. Boaz, as the real commander of the company, was the first to raise his head. He saw the smoke coming from the sewer, supposed that it was sewer gas that had exploded. Boaz slipped his hand into his pocket, pressed a button, fed to his company the signal that would make them stand up again. As they stood, Boaz stood too.
God damn, buddy, he said. I guess we done had a baptism of fire.
He picked up his end of the siege mortar's tube. There was nobody to pick up the other end. Unc had gone in search of his wife and son and his best friend. Unc had gone over the hill on the flat, 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 flat Mars. The son that Unc was looking for was named Chrono. Chrono was, by Earth reckoning, 8 years old. He was named after the month in which he had been born. The Martian year was divided into 21 months, 12 with 30 days, and 9 with 31. These months were named January, February, March, April, May, June, July, August, September, October, November, December, Winston, Niles, Rumford, Kazak, Newport, Chrono, Synclastic, Infundibulum, and Sallow. Mnemonically, 30 days have Sallow, Niles, June, and September, Winston, Chrono, Kazak, and November, April, Rumford, Newport, and Infundibulum. All the rest, baby mine, have 31. The month of Sallow was named after a creature Winston Niles Rumford knew on Titan. Titan, of course, is an extremely pleasant moon of Saturn. Sallow, Rumford's crony on Titan, was a messenger from another galaxy who was forced down on Titan by the failure of a part in his spaceship's power plant. He was waiting for a replacement part. He had been waiting patiently for 200,000 years. The ship was powered, and the Martian war effort was powered, by a phenomenon known as UWTB, or the Universal Will to Become. UWTB is what makes universes out of nothingness, that makes nothingness insist on becoming somethingness. Many Earthlings are glad that Earth does not have UWTB. As the popular doggerel has it, Willie found some universal will to become, mixed it with his bubble gum. Cosmic piddling seldom pays, poor Willie's 6 new Milky Ways. Unc's son Chrono was, at 8 years old, a wonderful player of a game called German Batball. German Batball was all he cared about. German Batball was the major sport on Mars, in the grammar school, in the army, and in the factory workers' recreation areas. Since there were only 52 children on Mars, Mars got along with just one grammar school, right in the middle of Phoebe. None of the 52 children there had been conceived on Mars. All had been conceived either on Earth or, as in Chrono's case, on a spaceship bringing new recruits to Mars. The children in the school studied very little, since the Society of Mars had no particular use for them. They spent most of their time playing German Batball. The game of German Batball is played with a flabby ball the size of a big honeydew melon. The ball is no more lively than a 10-gallon hat filled with rainwater. The game is something like baseball, with a batter striking the ball into a field of opposing players and running around bases, and with the fielders attempting to catch the ball and frustrate the runner. There are, however, only 3 bases in German Batball: first, second, and home. And the batter is not pitched to. He places the ball on one fist and strikes the ball with his other fist. And if a fielder succeeds in striking the runner with the ball when the runner is between bases, the runner is deemed out,
and must leave the playing field at once. The person responsible for the heavy emphasis on German batball on Mars was, of course, Winston Niles Rumford, who was responsible for everything on Mars. Howard W. Sams proves in his Winston Niles Rumford, Benjamin Franklin, and Leonardo da Vinci that German batball was the only team sport with which Rumford was at all familiar as a child. Sam shows that Rumford was taught the game, when a child, by his governess, a Miss Joyce McKenzie. Back in Rumford's childhood in Newport, a team composed of Rumford, Miss McKenzie, and Earl Moncrief the butler used to play German batball regularly against a team composed of Watanabe Wataru, the Japanese gardener, Beverly June Wataru, the gardener's daughter, and Edward Seward Darlington, the half-wit stable boy. Rumford's team invariably won. Unk, the only deserter in history of the Army of Mars, now crouched panting behind a turquoise boulder and watched the schoolchildren playing German batball on the iron playground. Behind the boulder, with Unk, was a bicycle he had stolen from a gas mask factory's bicycle rack. Unk did not know which child was his son, which child was Chrono. Unk's plans were nebulous. His dream was to gather together his wife, his son, and his best friend to steal a spaceship and to fly away someplace where they could all live happily ever after.
"Hey, Chrono!"
cried a child on the playground.
"You're up to bat!"
Unk peered around the boulder at home plate. The child who came up to bat there would be Chrono, would be his son. Chrono, Unk's son, came up to bat. He was small for his age, but surprisingly manly through the shoulders. The child's hair was jet black, bristly, and the black bristles grew in a violently counterclockwise swirl. The child was left-handed. The ball rested on his right fist, and he prepared to hit it with his left. His eyes were deep-set, like his father's eyes, and his eyes were luminous under their black thatched eaves. They glowed with an unshared rage. Those rage-filled eyes flickered this way, then that. Their movements rattled the fielders, drawing them away from their positions, convincing them that the slow, stupid ball was going to come at them with terrible speed, was going to tear them to pieces if they dared to get in the way. The alarm inspired by the boy at bat was felt by the teacher, too. She was in the traditional position for an umpire in German batball, between first and second base, and she was terrified. She was a frail old lady named Isabel Fernstermaker. She was 73, and had been a Jehovah's Witness before having her memory cleaned out. She had been shanghaied while trying to sell a copy of The Watchtower to a Martian agent in Duluth.
"Now, Chrono,"
she said simperingly,
"it's only a game, you know."
The sky was suddenly blackened by a formation of 100 flying saucers, the blood-red ships of the Martian Parachute Ski Marines. The combined cooing of the ships was a melodious thunder that rattled the schoolhouse window panes. But, as a measure of the importance young Chrono gave to German batball when he came to bat, not a single child looked up at the sky. Young Chrono, having brought the fielders and Miss Fenstermaker to the brink of nervous collapse, now put the ball down by his feet, took from his pocket a short strip of metal that was his good luck piece. He kissed the strip for luck, returned the strip to his pocket. Then he suddenly picked up the ball again, hit it with a mighty bloop, and went scrambling around the bases. The fielders and Miss Fenstermaker dodged the ball as though it were a red-hot cannonball. When the ball came to a stop of its own accord, the fielders went after it with a sort of ritual clumsiness. Clearly, the point of their efforts was not to hit Chrono with the ball, was not to put him out. The fielders were all conspiring to increase the glory of Chrono by making a show of helpless opposition. Clearly, Chrono was the most glorious thing that the children had ever seen on Mars, and any glory they themselves had came from their association with him. They would do anything to make his glory grow. young Chrono slid into home in a cloud of rust. A fielder hurled the ball at him. Too late, too late, much too late. The fielder ritually cursed his luck. Young Chrono stood, dusted himself off, and again kissed his good luck piece, thanked it for another home run. He believed firmly that all his powers came from the good luck piece, and so did his schoolmates, and so, secretly, did Miss Fenstermaker. The history of the good luck piece was this. One day, the school children were taken by Miss Fenstermaker on an educational tour of a flamethrower factory. The factory manager explained to the children all the steps in the manufacture of flamethrowers and hoped that some of the children, when they grew up, would want to work for him. At the end of the tour, in the packaging department, the manager's ankle became snarled in a spiral of steel strapping, a type of strapping that was used for binding shut packaged flamethrowers. The spiral was a piece of jagged-ended scrap that had been cast into the factory aisle by a careless workman. The manager scratched his ankle and tore his pants before he got free of the spiral. He thereupon put on the first really comprehensible demonstration that the children had seen that day. Comprehensibly, he blew up at the spiral. He stamped on it. Then, when it nipped him again, he snatched it up and chopped it into 4-inch lengths with great shears. The children were edified, thrilled, and satisfied. And, as they were leaving the packaging department, young Chrono picked up one of the 4-inch pieces and slipped it into his pocket. The piece he picked up differed from all the rest in having 2 holes drilled in it. This was Chrono's good luck piece. It became as much a part of him as his right hand. His nervous system, so to speak, extended itself into the metal strap. Touch it, and you touched Chrono. Unk, the deserter, stood up behind his turquoise boulder, walked vigorously and officiously into the schoolyard. He had stripped his uniform of all insignia. This gave him a rather official, warlike look, without binding him to any particular enterprise. Of all the equipment he had been carrying before he deserted, he retained only a jungle knife, his single-shot Mauser, and 1 grenade. These 3 weapons he left cached behind the boulder, along with the stolen bicycle. Unk marched up to Miss Fenstermaker. He told her that he wished to interview young Chrono on official business at once, privately. He did not tell her that he was the boy's father. Being the boy's father entitled him to nothing. Being an official investigator entitled him to anything he might care to ask for. Poor Miss Fenstermaker was easily fooled. She agreed to let Unk interview the boy in her own office. Her office was crammed with ungraded school papers, some of them dating back 5 years. She was far behind in her work, so far behind that she had declared a moratorium on schoolwork until she could catch up on her grading. Some of the stacks of papers had tumbled, forming glaciers that sent fingers under her desk, into the hallway, and into her private lavatory. There was an open 2-drawer filing cabinet filed with her rock collection. Nobody ever checked up on Miss Fenstermaker. Nobody cared. She had a teaching certificate from the state of Minnesota, USA, Earth, Solar System, Milky Way, and that was all that mattered. For his interview with his son, Unk sat behind her desk while his son Chrono stood before him. It was Chrono's wish to remain standing. Unk, in planning the things he would say, idly opened Miss Fenstermaker's desk drawers, found that they were filled with rocks too. Young Chrono was shrewd and hostile, and he thought of something to say before Unk did.
"Baloney," he said.
"What?" said Unk.
"Whatever you say, it's baloney," said the 8-year-old.
"What makes you think so?" said Unk.
"Everything anybody says is baloney," said Chrono. "What you care what I think anyway? When I'm 14, you put a thing in my head and I do whatever you want anyway."
He was referring to the fact that antennas were not installed in the skulls of children until their 14th year. This was a matter of skull size. When a child reached his 14th birthday, he was sent to the hospital for the operation. His hair was shaved off, and the doctors and nurses joshed him about having entered adulthood. Before the child was wheeled into the operating room, he was asked to name his favorite kind of ice cream. When the child awoke after the operation, a big dish of that kind of ice cream was waiting for him. Maple walnut, butter crunch, chocolate chip, anything.
"Is your mother full of baloney?" said Unc.
"She isn't. She came back from the hospital this last time," said Crono.
"What about your father?" said Unc.
"I don't know anything about him," said Crono. "I don't care. He's full of baloney like everybody else."
"Who isn't full of baloney?" said Unc.
"I'm not full of baloney," said Crono. "I'm the only one."
"Come closer," said Unc.
"Why should I?"
said Crono. "Because I'm going to whisper something very important."
"I doubt it," said Crono.
Unc got up from the desk, went around to Crono, and whispered in his ear,
"I'm your father, boy."
When Unc said those words, his heart went off like a burglar alarm. Crono was unmoved.
"So what?"
he said stonily. He had never received any instructions, had never seen an example in life that would make him think a father was of any importance. On Mars, the word was emotionally meaningless.
"I've come to get you," said Unc. "Somehow, we're going to get away from here."
He shook the boy gently, trying to make him bubble a little. Crono peeled his father's hand from his arm as though his hand were a leech.
"And do what?"
he said.
"Live," said Unc.
The boy looked over his father dispassionately, seeking one good reason why he should throw in his lot with this stranger. Crono took his good luck piece from his pocket and rubbed it between his palms. The imagined strength he got from the good luck piece made him strong enough to trust nobody, to go on as he had for so long, angry and alone.
"I'm living,"
he said.
"I'm all right,"
he said.
"Go to hell."
Unc took a step backward. The corners of his mouth pulled down.
"Go to hell," he whispered.
"I tell everybody to go to hell,"
said the boy. He was trying to be kind, but he wearied of the effort at once.
"Can I go out and play bat ball now?"
"You tell your own father to go to hell?" murmured Unc.
The question echoed back through Unc's emptied memory to an untouched corner where bits of his own strange childhood still lived. His own strange childhood had been spent in daydreams of at last seeing a loving father who did not want to see him, who did not want to be loved by him.
I deserted from the army to come here, to find you," said Unc.
Interest flickered in the boy's eyes, then died.
"They'll get you,"
he said.
"They get everybody."
"I'll steal a spaceship," said Unc. "And you and your mother and I will get on it, and we'll fly away."
"To where?"
said the boy.
"Someplace good," said Unc.
"Tell me about someplace good,"
said Crono.
"I don't know. We'll have to look," said Unc.
Crono shook his head pityingly.
"I'm sorry," he said. "I don't think you know what you're talking about. You just get a lot of people killed."
"You want to stay here?" said Unc.
"I'm all right here," said Crono. "Can I go out and play bat ball now?"
Unc wept. His weeping appalled the boy. He had never seen a man weep before. He never wept himself.
"I'm going out to play,"
he cried wildly, and he ran out of the office. Unc went to the window of the office. He looked out at the iron playground. Young Crono's team was in the field now. Young Crono joined his teammates, faced a batter whose back was to Unc. Crono kissed his good luck piece, put it in his pocket.
"Easy out, you guys,"
he yelled hoarsely.
"Come on, you guys. Let's kill him."
Unc's mate, the mother of young Crono, was an instructress in the Schliemann Breathing School for recruits. Schliemann breathing, of course, is a technique that enables human beings to survive in a vacuum or in inhospitable atmosphere without the use of helmets or other cumbersome respiratory gear. It consists essentially of taking a pill rich in oxygen. The bloodstream takes on this oxygen through the wall of the small intestine rather than through the lungs. On Mars, the pills were known officially as combat respiratory rations, in popular parlance as goofballs. Schliemann breathing is at its simplest in a benign but useless atmosphere like that of Mars. The breather goes on breathing and talking in a normal manner, though there is no oxygen for his lungs to take in from the atmosphere. All he has to remember is to take his goofballs regularly. The school in which Unk's mate was an instructress taught recruits the more difficult techniques necessary in a vacuum or in a harmful atmosphere. This involves not only pill-taking, but plugging one's ears and nostrils and keeping one's mouth shut as well. Any effort to speak or to breathe would result in hemorrhages and probably death. Unk's mate was one of six instructresses at the Schliemann Breathing School for recruits. Her classroom was a bare, windowless, whitewashed room, 30 feet square. Ranged around the walls were benches. On the table in the middle was a bowl of goofballs, a bowl of nose and ear plugs, a roll of adhesive plaster, scissors, and a small tape recorder. Purpose of the tape recorder was to play music during the long periods in which there was nothing to do but sit and wait patiently for nature to take its course. Such a period had been reached now. The class had just been dosed with goofballs. Now the students had to sit quietly on the benches and listen to music and wait for the goofballs to reach their small intestines. The tune being played had been pirated recently from an Earthling broadcast. It was a big hit on Earth. A trio composed for a boy, a girl, and cathedral bells. It was called God is Our Interior Decorator. The boy and the girl sang alternate lines of the verses and joined in close harmony on the choruses. The cathedral bells whang.